was detained for 2 years. Andrew Bronson was arrested over alleged links to political groups, including banned Gulenist movement, after a failed coup attempt in 2016.
Mesela bence taviz vermemeliyiz. Çok uzakta olan bir ülke bizim için. Ama bu bölgede politik gücünü göstermek isteyen bir ülke. O yüzden yapacak çok fazla bir şey yok. Direnmeye devam.
As you just saw, the Turks were behind their president there. They even heeded his call to cash in their dollars for liras, so the country won't run out of reserves.
Every day they are changing about the 100,000, maybe 300,000, but some days they are coming us to $50,000 and $100,000. They are changing. Turkish people is supporting to the Erdogan. We are doing this for our economy.
The Turkish president's foreign policy adventures have also come at a cost to Turkey's economy, and it has been blamed for creating tensions with many countries as a result, even the US. All of this has come at a cost for Turkey and the Turkish president, whose popularity along with his party has dropped to an all-time low. With the 2023 elections coming up, many are speculating that Erdogan's time as president are numbered. That does it for my part. Please send us your comments or questions. Our links and addresses are on your screen. It's goodbye until next week.
Turkey's economic problems will get solved eventually. At least, they hope so. But to blame the Turkish president only, that would be wrong and the unfair thing to do. I mean, after all, the COVID pandemic has impacted major economies around the world. But one thing Turkey can do is what it did a while back under its former president, Abdullah Gül. Zero problem with neighbors. Now this could be a great start in making a difference, especially when it comes to the economy. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Until next week, I'm Kavit Ali.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. Amid the recent chip shortage, Dutch company ASML's products have become central to a geopolitical struggle between the United States and China, with Washington making it a high priority to block China's access to the machines. So far, the US government has pressured the Dutch not to grant the export licenses needed to send the extreme ultraviolet lithography machines to China. We now present you an article written by Dave Makichuk. The piece is titled, The 150 $150 million machine that will change the world. The article has been published by the New York Times. Each machine is roughly the size of a bus and costs a hefty $150 million. It contains 100,000 parts and 2 kilometers of cable. Shipping the equipment to customers requires 40 shipping containers, 20 trucks, and 3 Boeing 747s. Only a few companies can afford them, and most of them go to the world's 3 leading edge chip makers. Taiwan-based TSMC, as well as Samsung in South Korea and Intel. Jesus del Alamo, a professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, says, "It is really an incredible machine." He added, "It's an absolutely revolutionary product, a breakthrough that is going to give a new lease of life to the industry for years." So what exactly is it, and what does it do? For starters, it's a game changer, and that's putting it lightly. According to a report in Wired, built by the Dutch company ASML, Advanced Semiconductor Materials International, these extreme ultraviolet lithography machines have cornered the market for etching the tiniest nanoscopic features into microchips with light. The company's newest extreme ultraviolet system, a part of which is being built in Wilton, Connecticut, will use a new trick to minimize the wavelength of light it uses, shrinking the size of features on the resulting chips and boosting their performance more than ever. The pace of that miniaturization is known as Moore's Law, named after Gordon Moore, a co-founder of the chip giant Intel. ASML introduced the first extreme ultraviolet lithography machines for mass production in 2017, after decades spent mastering the technique. Known as high NA technology, it will be crucial for making more advanced smartphones and cloud computers, and also for key areas of emerging technology such as artificial intelligence, biotechnology, and robotics. The first chips made using the new system may be minted by Intel, which has said it will get the first of them expected by 2023. But how does it all work? The chip starts out life as a cylindrical chunk of crystalline silicon that is sliced into thin wafers, which are then coated with layers of light-sensitive material and repeatedly exposed to patterned light. The parts of silicon not touched by the light are then chemically etched away to reveal the intricate details of a chip. Each wafer is then chopped up to make lots of individual chips. Shrinking the components of a chip remains the surest way to squeeze more computational power out of pieces of silicon, because electrons pass more efficiently through smaller electronic components. Reducing the wavelength of light used in chip manufacturing has helped drive miniaturization and progress from the 1960s onwards, and it is crucial to the next advance. Machines that use visible light are replaced by those that use near ultraviolet, which in turn gave way to systems that employ deep ultraviolet in order to etch ever smaller features into chips. Generating extreme ultraviolet light is itself a big problem. ASML's method involves directing high-power lasers at droplets of tin, 50,000 times per second, to generate generate high-intensity light. Lenses absorb extreme ultraviolet frequencies, so the system uses incredibly precise mirrors, built by 175-year-old German optics firm Zeiss Group, coated with special materials instead. The six specially shaped mirrors are ground, polished, and coated over several months in an elaborate robotic process that uses ion beams to remove defects. Inside ASML's machine, extreme ultraviolet light bounces off the mirrors before passing through the reticle, which moves with nanoscale precision to etch features just a few dozen atoms in size onto future computer chips. Amid the recent chip shortage, ASML's products have become central to a geopolitical struggle between the United States and China, with Washington making it a high priority to block China's access to the machines. So far, the U.S. government has successfully pressured the Dutch not to grant the export licenses needed to send the machines to China. Will Hunt, a research analyst at Georgetown University studying the geopolitics of chip making, says, "You can't make leading-edge chips without ASML's machines." He added, "A lot of it comes down to years and years of tinkering with things and experimenting, and it's very difficult to get access to that." He says each component that goes into an extreme ultraviolet machine is astonishingly sophisticated and extraordinarily complex. ASML's current generation of extreme ultraviolet machines can create chips with a resolution of 13 nanometers. The next generation will use High-NA to craft features 8 nanometers in size. The extreme ultraviolet market is highly consolidated, as ASML is the only manufacturer of lithography machines that use extreme ultraviolet light. Asia Pacific continues to hold the largest revenue share in the global market for extreme ultraviolet lithography, with Taiwan expected to have an edge in the region over the forecast period from 2021 to 2026. The boom in demand means that ASML's executive team now expects the company to post a 35% jump in sales this year, compared with the 14 billion euro total posted in 2020. The company's chief executive officer, Peter Wennink, says that in addition to demand from chip manufacturers, ASML is set to benefit from a trend towards technological sovereignty, with the United States and Europe looking to ensure local production of critical semiconductors. The chief executive officer of ASML is expecting continued long-term demand growth to meet the needs of what he calls intelligent distributed systems that combine sensors with computation. Peter Wennink added, "It's the further rollout of 5G and 6G. It's the progress we're making on artificial intelligence and self-driving cars."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
year-long war between government forces and fighters of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, is feared to intensify. The TPLF is the party ruling in the northern Tigray region. It used to hold power in Ethiopia until the parliamentary elections in 2018, when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed took over with the support of country's largest ethnic groups, the Oromo and Amhara. On Friday, however, eight rebel groups, including the Oromo Liberation Front, agreed in Washington to join forces with the TPLF to form a coalition against the government, striking up an alliance between the historic foes.
The main reason why this alliance is significant is it's another example of them using this level of psychological warfare. This particular announcement, and what I would like to say grandiose event in D.C., coupled with the media's focus of the armies marching to the Capitol in the last few days, is just another way to create this level of manufactured consent from the people so they can feel as though, wow, well, the Ethiopian government is already lost, so I must try to put my hope into TPLF or this alliance in some case.
Ethiopia declared a nationwide state of emergency on the 2nd of November amid concerns that the forces, which are now within a day's drive from the capital Addis Ababa, may be considering attacking the city. The United Nations Security Council called for a halt to the fighting in Ethiopia on Friday, urging talks to end intensifying hostilities.
They further called to put an end to hostilities and to negotiate a lasting ceasefire and for the creation of conditions for the start of an inclusive Ethiopian national dialogue to resolve the crisis and create the foundation for peace and stability throughout the country.
The council members also expressed deep concern about the growing violence in northern Ethiopia. They urged the warring sides to refrain from inflammatory hate speech and incitement to violence. The council members also called for unhindered access for humanitarian aid and the reestablishment of public services, among others. The announcement of the alliance between nine Ethiopian rebel groups in Washington coincided with the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman's meeting with the Ethiopian Prime Minister amid calls for an immediate ceasefire and talks to end the war.
It's really interesting to note that TPLF has had a long-standing relationship to the U.S. and other European powers. I mean, the evidence here is look at the ruling party within TPLF or the different officials and generals, and look at their assets and where they're stored.
The United Nations published a report this week that suggests both sides of the conflict have committed atrocities that may amount to war crimes. The conflict in the Tigray region erupted on November 4th last year when Ethiopia launched an offensive against the TPLF troops who allegedly attacked a federal army camp. The government declared victory at the end of November, but clashes have continued in the region. Soon after the start of the conflict, Eritrea, TPLF's longtime enemy, joined Ethiopia in attacking the rebels. The UN report suggests that Eritrean troops have also killed hundreds of civilians in Tigray in a matter of days. Due to a communications blackout and restricted access to the region for journalists, little is known about the extent of humanitarian crisis in the region. The fate of millions of Ethiopians is now hanging in the balance with no end in sight for their persecution in the absence of any meaningful international action.
Taiwan is an island in East Asia which has been self-ruled since 1950. The People's Republic of China regards it as a breakaway region that must one day be reunited with the mainland. Beijing has never ruled out the use of force to bring the island under its control. The situation has become very tense since President Tsai Ing-wen came into office in 2016. She has said Taiwan is independent and not part of China. The United States and some of its European allies have been expanding their relations with Taiwan despite Chinese opposition. The Chinese government has been angered by the growing trade and military ties between the West and Taiwan. In response to the West's growing support for the island, China has been flexing its military muscles in the region.
Tensions escalated this week between the U.S. and China over Taiwan after America's top general signaled that America stands ready to intervene if a conflict erupts in the region. U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley said the U.S. military absolutely could defend Taiwan from a potential Chinese attack if asked to do so. How far is the United States really willing to go over Taiwan? Will it be ready to confront another nuclear-armed superpower, given all the risks and possible costs involved, where success is not guaranteed at all?
This sounds very much like typical political positioning before some sort of a negotiation. The United States certainly does not have any positive interest in making a war over Taiwan, except, of course, to sell weapons and to spend taxpayers' money.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said on Thursday that, quote, the negative and erroneous words and deeds of the U.S. related to the Taiwan question have encouraged the blatancy of the Taiwan secessionists. He also blamed Washington for the increasing tension across the Taiwan Strait. Beijing has reiterated that the issue of Taiwan is a red line that must not be crossed, but the West seems to be determined to challenge China. This week, the European Parliament's first official delegation to the island said Taiwan is not alone and called for measures to bolster EU-Taiwan ties. Beijing condemned the trip, urging the European side to correct its mistakes and not send any wrong signals to Taiwan, warning that it will harm China-EU relations. Where does Europe really stand on this issue?
The Europeans are typically following Germany and making supportive sounds in the support of U.S. foreign policy, but are not prepared to physically become engaged, especially after the debacle in Afghanistan. So I would suggest that we can call the European comments on this topic chatter on the line. In other words, a background noise that's not critical to the situation.
The EU seems to be following policies close to those of the U.S. The West knows all too well that China is highly unlikely to back down on the issue of Taiwan. Why is it then being so provocative? Is it trying to create a conflict in the region close to China's borders? The U.S. has been selling many billions of dollars worth of weapons to the self-ruled island. And U.S. President Joe Biden has made no secret of his priority to contain China's influence. This leaves little doubt that Taiwan will remain a very serious bone of contention between the two sides for years to come.
The naval forces of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, have managed to thwart an attempt by the United States to take over a giant oil tanker in the strategic sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, intended to unload the shipment to another tanker and then direct it to an unknown destination. But IRGC forces reacted promptly and carried out a heli-borne operation on the stolen ship's deck, gained control of the vessel, and directed it back toward Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces then proceeded to chase the tanker using several helicopters and warships, but their attempt at taking over the vessel for a second time was thwarted again by Iranian naval forces. The tanker is currently in Iranian territorial waters and under the protection of IRGC's Navy.
The United States continues to use oil and weaponize oil against Iran because it has not been able to overthrow the Iranian Islamic Revolution in any other way.
Iran has repeatedly warned the U.S. about its military adventurism in the Persian Gulf. Tehran says it has increased its patrols to secure the passage of Iranian ships and to combat fuel smuggling in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
The U.S. will try to provoke some sort of conflict in the Persian Gulf because of this, and we have to keep this in mind because the Persian Gulf belongs to Iran. Iran and the people of the Middle East, not the United States. The United States should not be there to begin with.
Iranian officials say U.S. military presence in the region is a source of instability and insecurity. Iran believes the countries of the region are fully capable of providing their own security. The latest confrontation between the U.S. and Iran comes amid rising bilateral and regional tensions.
The United States continues its presence in the Persian Gulf because it is a key geopolitical trade route. Most of the energy, commerce, petroleum, commodities that are exchanged on the global market are done so in the Persian Gulf. Because if we look geographically at a map, the Persian Gulf connects trade in Europe across Egypt through the Suez Canal and leads into the Indian Ocean.
Washington has tried to disrupt the legitimate oil trade of Iran with other countries. The U.S. has threatened Iran over its fuel deliveries to Lebanon and Venezuela. It believes that the sanctions it has imposed on Iran should be adhered by Iran under its so-called maximum pressure campaign. But this is a campaign that has failed, even admitted by some U.S. officials. Tensions have risen between Iran and the U.S. after the U.S. pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal as part of a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The campaign included tough economic sanctions combined with credible military threat. Washington's European allies failed to live up to their commitments.
For many years, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the United States, Washington, London, the Western imperialist powers have done everything they can to try to overthrow the popular revolution, the government.
The administration of U.S. President Biden says it wants to rejoin the deal, but at the same time, it is pressing ahead with failed maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has also said in a tweet that the talks to remove sanctions on Iran would fail unless U.S. President Joe Biden could guarantee that Washington would not renege on the nuclear agreements in the future.
And the U.S. maintains its presence in the Persian Gulf because it sees that Iran has been able to withstand so many imperialist attacks, and also that Iran has many friends around the world. Let's recall just a few weeks ago in the lead up to this piracy by the U.S. that Iran was able to successfully bring petroleum refineries to the nation of Venezuela.
Now, talks have been set to resume on November 29th, but the talks are aimed at removing illegal U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran. That is Iran's approach towards the talks. Only time will tell whether the U.S. will remove the sanctions or that the talks will fail.
November 2nd marks the anniversary of declaration that proved disastrous to the Palestinian people. The Balfour Declaration is named after Lord Arthur Balfour, the then British Foreign Secretary who penned the document. The Balfour Declaration was a public statement issued by the UK government during World War I, announcing support for the creation of Israel. Palestinians view the declaration as a prelude to the Israeli occupation of their homeland in 1948, saying the UK government should apologize for issuing the document. The war leading to Israel's creation caused some 750,000 Palestinians either to flee or being expelled from their homes in what they call the Nakba or catastrophe. The British allowed the Jews to establish self-governing institutions, such as the Jewish Agency, while the Palestinians were forbidden from doing so, paving the way for the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine.
It's absolutely the source of the conflict. People who pretend that the deterioration began in 1967 with Israel's conquest of the West Bank and Gaza are deluding themselves. Zionism was a colonizing project which set out to establish a Jewish majority to remove as many Palestinians as they possibly could.
Emboldened by the Balfour Declaration and the ensuing Western support, Israel captured huge swathes of Arab land in a war in 1948 and then proclaimed its existence. In 1967, it proceeded to capture more Palestinian territory in another war. It then started propping up scores of settlements across that occupied territory in a move to gradually annex it. Tel Aviv has defied all international condemnations of its settlement activities, including outright denunciation by the United Nations.
And because Zionism is a system of Jewish supremacy over Palestinians across the whole of Palestine, the Zionists came to Palestine not to live alongside the Palestinians, not to be immigrants like in a normal country, but to displace the Palestinians. So yes, the problem is Zionism, and until the Zionist program of colonization and dispossession is ended, there's no possibility of a resolution to the crisis.
There are a set of reasons over which there is a general consensus about why Britain issued the Balfour Declaration. Control over Palestine was a strategic imperial interest to keep Egypt and the Suez Canal within Britain's sphere of influence. Britain sided with the Zionists to rally support among Jews in the United States and Russia, hoping they could encourage their governments to stay in the war until victory. There was also intense Zionist lobbying and strong connections between the Zionist community in Britain and the British government. Some of the officials in the government were Zionists themselves. While Britain is generally held responsible for the Balfour Declaration, it is important to note that this statement would not have been made without prior approval from the other Allied powers during World War I.
Colonialism was substantially rolled back and defeated in the 50s and 60s and 70s with independence for countries in Africa and Asia. So the Israeli project is an anachronism. It's out of time. It flies in the face of the laws that were passed in Nuremberg after the Second World War against the conquest of territory by force and the dispossession of the natives. But the Palestinians don't seem to be protected by that law.
In 1917, British ministers decided that the views of U.S. President Wilson should be obtained before any declaration was made. According to documents, the ministers recalled Arthur Balfour, confirming that Wilson was extremely favorable to the movement. France was also involved and announced its support prior to the issuing of the Balfour Declaration. A May 1917 letter from Jules Cambon, a French diplomat, to Nahum Sokolow, a Polish Zionist, expressed the sympathetic views of the French government towards, quote, Jewish colonization in Palestine.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
very heart of evergreen forests. Under the starry sky of the desert. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
An Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Dust and clean my house once a week. Indeed, it's not a pleasant job to do, but after everything gets clean and neat, it would be enjoyable for me. And here I have a few sculptures, which their dusting is a little hard. I was close to drop it. This sculpture is a replica of one of the works of Parviz Tanavuli, who is a well-known Iranian artist whose sculptures are universally known. Before I forget, let me tell you something. We are going to visit the statue or sculpture garden of Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art in order to get familiar with some of the masterpieces of the world's sculptors. Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art was built in 1977 on the western corner of Lale Park. This museum, along with the gardens around it, have been built in an area of 8,500 square meters. In the exterior area of the museum, there are modern sculptures of world prominent artists. Many of these masterpieces are unique. Every year, tourists from around the world travel to Iran and Tehran to visit these art masterpieces. Among the artists that have created these works in the sculpture garden, mention can be made of Henry Moore, Max Ernst, Alberto Giacometti, Carl Schlaminger, Marino Marini, René Magritte, Mark Spill, Eduardo Chilida, Parviz Tanavuli, and Dariush Sanizadeh. I am now in Lale Park, and I'm going to visit the statue garden of Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art. To be honest, I'm so excited. Seeing the great works of the world's artists is so exciting, and I'm so happy that these works are in Tehran. Beside a big sphere. This This sphere is made of bronze with gold patina. This spherical statue is 156 centimeters. Some parts of it are cracked, and a small little sphere inside this sphere is visible. Inside the sphere, the architectural elements and ordered forms are intermingled together. Arnoldo Pomodoro, Italian artist, has made this artistic work. And now let's take a look at another sculpture. Well, this sculpture is made of steel. Actually, describing this modern statue is a hard job to do. You have to visit it yourself. And this artwork is called Homage to Pablo Neruda. The artist of this work is Spanish, and his name is Eduardo Chillida. Initially, he made the statues by clay, but later on, he used metal in making his works. This statue is made by my favorite artist, René Magritte. René Magritte is a Belgian surrealist artist, and in this work of Magritte, we see a man sitting on a platform. All the work is made of bronze. This man has a stick in one hand and a bag in another hand. The man has a birdcage under his neck instead of chest. And he has no head. His hat is on the man's cloak. It's a bizarre thing. This statue is called Le Thérapeute and was built in 1967. And now I'm standing by a statue made by the prominent Iranian artist and sculptor Parviz Tanavoli. And of course, describing this bronze statue is also hard, and you have to come here to see it yourself. Well, in my opinion, if there was nothing like art in the world, and the artist didn't exist to show us new perspectives of the world, life would be a very boring place for us to live. Don't you agree with me? Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavik Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, has slammed the recent U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, saying it confirms the contradiction in Biden's administration when it comes to Yemen. In a tweet, Al-Houthi said the arms sales once again proved that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden had no real intention to stop the support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
America.
The United States is leading the war on Yemen and supports the Saudi-led coalition logistically and militarily. Washington's claims that it would stop the war on Yemen are incorrect, and the evidence for that is the continuation of the U.S. support for terrorist groups across the country. And this was proved through what the Yemeni army found in Al-Qaeda weapons warehouses with USAID logos.
Observers say Biden's promises to stop the war in Yemen have been nothing but lies to gain more votes in the elections. They say the new U.S. missiles sold to Riyadh will be used to bomb Yemenis and fighter jets such as F-15 and not as defensive weapons, contrary to what Washington claims.
The pre-election statements of the U.S. administration were only aimed at winning more votes, and the promises that the support for the Saudi regime and the war on Yemen would be halted were false. The U.S. administration proved that it supports the Saudi regime and that it only seeks to earn more money. The new deal is for offensive weapons. So the new U.S. administration is directly contributing to killing more Yemenis.
Saudi Arabia, with Washington's support, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Over the years, the kingdom has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. cluster bombs, to target residential areas, according to the Cluster Ammunition Monitor.
Yemenis have long been accusing the U.S. of being the main supporter of the brutal Saudi-led war on their country. People here say they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces, as the armed struggle seems to be the only way to force Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of anti-establishment protesters linked to the global hacktivist group Anonymous near the British Houses of Parliament under heavy police presence in a demonstration dubbed the Million Mask March.
They have a long list of grievances, from the government's performance on the climate crisis to its response to the pandemic to infringement of civil liberties, as well as its support for military intervention abroad.
It's all corruption. It's all fakery as well. They benefit from wars. We don't. We wouldn't have a war. All of these cenotaphs and everything, yeah, we care about the people of our families who have died, but none of these people would have voted for any war, any war. The governments do that, and we have to go around, you know, like, praising them up or doing what they say. No. No.
The event happens on the same date every year, the 5th of November, a date associated with an attempted attack on Parliament in 1605. But instead of the traditional burning of an effigy of one of the culprits by the name of Guy Fawkes and a bonfire each year, the group don masks made popular by the novel and movie V for Vendetta. They say they're symbolic of standing up to power. They also wear them to protect their identities, to remain anonymous. To their supporters, they're freedom fighters or digital Robin Hoods. Among the crowd, the Palestinian flag, and supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in the UK.
Well, as you've seen with Julian's case, it's the judiciary system. The whole system is corrupt from the roots. You have political prisoners, you have a war on the free press and independent journalists. I know a journalist here who's been arrested before just for filming the police, the criminality. We're not, if anyone thinks we live in a democracy, they really need to wake up. They need to wake up. We're not in a democracy. Democracy has several pillars. One of them is free press. One of them is the right to assemble, free speech. All of these are dead.
The mostly peaceful Million Mask March started in 2003 and has grown bigger in number. A grassroots group that says it aims to shed light on government corruption and protect liberty. Saeed Purza, London.
The United States has approved a potential weapon sale worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Saudi Arabia. On Thursday, the Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The State Department said the sale is fully consistent with the administration's pledge to co-lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen while also ensuring Saudi Arabia has the means to defend itself. Yemen's Ansarullah movement reacted, saying the arms sales prove that U.S. administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. This is seen as the first major arms sales to Riyadh since President Joe Biden took the helm at the White House. But such weapons transfer is not limited to the current administration. In May 2017, former President Donald Trump signed a mega weapons sales deal worth $110 billion in a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The recent deals have made Saudi Arabia become the largest importer of American arms and munitions. According to a report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, one-fourth of America's arms exports go directly to the kingdom. The report also says that between 2016 and 2020, Saudi weapons purchases only from the United States accounted for 79% of the country's total arms imports. Many believe the U.S. weapon sales to Saudi Arabia serves no one but arms manufacturing companies.
These are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapon sales, which benefit Raytheon and benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
But the United States is not the only country that provides Saudis with weapons. The UK, Canada, Spain, France, Italy, and Germany are among other major exporters of weapons to the Al Saud dynasty. The arms supplies of Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. Anti-war and human rights organizations have long sounded the alarm over the loss of human lives as a result of the West-backed Saudi aggression on Yemen. It seems the U.S. and its Western allies have no concern for misery the Saudi-led coalition have been inflicting on Yemenis. They are rather concerned about petrodollars they receive in return for those weapons being used in the impoverished Arab country.
Last-minute high-level talks in Paris to avert French sanctions on the United Kingdom did not produce any breakthrough, but both sides have agreed to continue discussions. A dispute over fishing boat licensing surprisingly ballooned into swift threats of sanctions and bans on using French ports unless London backed down. The row only concerns about 200 French fishing boats, some of which may be unable or unwilling to prove that they have not been fishing illegally in UK waters. The extremely low economic impact of the dispute has many saying the affair has become overly politicized, with French President Emmanuel Macron posturing ahead of re-election next spring, and the UK with their own questionable motives.
We see the economic problems the UK is having after Brexit, with shortages of gas and goods that appear rather serious. This dispute allows their government to focus attention elsewhere. But fishermen of both nations always have an interest in finding harmony together and sharing natural resources.
But the dispute does reveal the complex and long-lasting nature of the Brexit secession. Analysts say that as the UK's largest trading partner, the European Union holds the best cards. Tougher customs checks, which have not been implemented since Brexit, could cause major delays for British companies and costs which far outweigh sales of fish. France's Prime Minister recently shocked many when he asked the head of the European Commission to, quote, show that it is more damaging to leave the Union than to stay in it. The openly punitive stance has many saying it's an unabashed method to keep countries in the European Union, not by persuasion, but by intimidation.
The EU still doesn't exclude the use of sanctions, but they have consistently been in favor of more negotiations. Our government has said they will follow the lead of the Brussels. So many French fishermen have a real feeling of injustice and of being neglected. We certainly hope our government will put pressure on London, because we cannot go on like this with major losses.
Many expect Brexit to become a perpetual problem in UK-EU relations. And with France, sometimes an ally, sometimes a competitor, but always a neighbor, bilateral relations are likely to get more strained as Brexit solidifies into permanence. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Former prosecutor, anti-corruption maverick, and political novice Yoon Suk-yeol Friday won the nomination to run for president of South Korea for the Conservative People Power Party.
The South Korean people, who want to restore fairness and common sense in our society, have chosen me, a political novice. Instead of happiness, I feel a sense of responsibility and duty to achieve a change of government.
Former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung won the Democratic Party nomination October 10th and proposes a universal basic income among several liberal policies.
Rooting out unfairness, inequality, and corruption, and making a wealthy country where workers are respected are the clear and stern commands from the public.
Early polling shows the candidates running neck and neck.
I support Yoon Suk-yeol because I think that the government of this country ridiculing people should be replaced as soon as possible because lies after lies continue.
I support Lee Jae-myung because he has gone through very difficult times and overcome everything by himself to get where he is now, and he is open and above board as well as firm.
The two main candidates for president of South Korea, conservative Yoon Suk-yeol and Democrat Lee Jae-myung, clash on a number of issues, including North Korea policy. Lee favors peace-building engagement with Pyongyang, whereas Yoon advocates strengthening the alliance with the United States through regular military exercises. South Korea's presidential election is slated for March 9th next year, with the winner set to serve a single 5-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
France has been shocked by a report which found that 20% of all the nation's hospital beds have been closed since the start of the pandemic. That total number of closed beds is twice as many as in 2019. Which also reveals that hospitals have been running at under capacity for some time. Unions gathered to clarify the situation, and they said it's even worse than it seems. The 20% number includes private hospitals, but it's public hospitals which have seen their funding cut almost annually since 2009.
As recently as the year 2000, France's medical system was ranked number one in the world by the United Nations. That claim can no longer be made following more than a decade of austerity, and perhaps no group has protested as often in recent years as medical professionals.
It's not only the lack of resources which is keeping hospitals underutilized or even closed, but also a lack of medical personnel. Studies show that during the age of austerity, public jobs, once eliminated, are not returning, even in hospitals during a once-in-a-century pandemic. What unions repeatedly accused is that the coronavirus is being instrumentalized by France's neoliberals to accelerate their open and long-standing goal of defunding public services even amid the corona instability.
We have this conviction that the government is manipulating corona because they were forcing the cuts before corona. Only the cuts are now coming even faster. In the middle of a pandemic, hospitals are being closed and services are no longer being offered, from our biggest and best public hospitals to smaller ones.
For public medical professionals, working conditions and pressures have dramatically worsened over the last 20 months, causing many to quit and turn over to the private sector. Unions say many of those resigned posts also never get refilled. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Soon after, Prime Minister Modi won a landslide victory in the 2014 general elections. Like other leaders, he wouldn't shy away from talking about the spirit of democracy. The Prime Minister said democracy will sustain only by freedom of speech and expression.